Welcome to the Max Move Podcast, a podcast about New York City theater. This is Lindsay Behrens. I'm the founder of Max Move, a website that makes recommendations to theater beyond Broadway in New York City. On this episode, we do a deep dive into a couple of shows currently playing in New York, including Roundabout's Mosh and All, where we seriously talk for 20 minutes about all manner of minutia, including Morgan Spector's tattoos. We also chat about What's It All About at New York Theater Workshop, Outside Mullingar, the new John Patrick Shanley play on Broadway, Bedlam Theater's production of St. Joan, and we end with a digression on durational work. Enjoy the show.
Mosh and All.
Mosh and All. Is that right?
I've been calling
it is? Oh, God. I've been calling it Mackinac like an asshole.
Would you like me to talk about that?
How you it sounds it? Like you have some some thoughts.
I had to go look it up because I called Roundabout to change my tickets for whatever reason because I'm a stupid member. And subscriber, whatever you call them. And I was like, I'd like to change my tickets to Mosh and All and, or Mackinac. And they're like, for Mosh and All, we have available. And I was like... And I got really annoyed that this person, they didn't correct me, but they
first
pronounced it differently. And then I was like, God damn it. And so I went and looked it up. And it's a very controversial subject historically. I guess the writer intended it to be Mosh and All, based on the French for machine. But when it opened on Broadway in the 20s, people referred to it as Mackinac. I mean, so it has this very controversial history over how you pronounce it, as far as I'm concerned. But... just so you guys know.
Okay.
Mosh and All. We stand corrected.
I'm not trying to, I mean, you know, I had to go find her, like the Sophie Treadwell archives are at some, like through a Catholic organization out in New Mexico or Arizona. Something,
wow.
Something kooky. And they have a website that actually has a whole, like, this is how you pronounce it
oh, man.
Section.
There's too many of those in my head
totally
right now.
I totally thought you were going to say, like, so I went to Albuquerque.
I got on a plane and I demanded to know
I
how
needed
you
to know
this.
How
this right.
Mosh and All and Gatto. Okay, I'm got it.
I know. It's been the season of
challenging pronunciation.
Breaking down my world.
Okay, let's go with introductions. Nicole.
Hi, I'm Nicole. I write about theater at Mildly Bitter's Musings and the Craptacular.
And Jack.
I'm Jack. I write for Maximood.com and I also work at the Public Theater in New York.
Okay, and we'll note that Jack is here in his personal capacity, not as a representative of the public, and his opinions are his own. And I'm Lindsay. I am the founder of Max Move, a website that makes recommendations about theater beyond Broadway in New York City. I have to do that again. That sounded so weird.
It was awesome.
Sometimes you have a hard time with your job.
With your voices.
Beyond Broadway is not easy to say. Okay, I'm Lindsay. And I'm the founder of Max Move, a website that makes recommendations for theater beyond Broadway in New York City. Okay, that was better.
Nailed it.
All right, let's talk about stuff we've seen recently, starting with Mosh and All.
Mosh and All. Not to be confused, it's Mosh and All.
Nicole, why don't you describe it?
Okay, this is a... famous play from the 1920s by Sophie Treadwell, and it is...
That sounded like a question.
And,
was that a question?
All of a sudden, I had like this moment of like, am I forgetting?
Sophie? Is it Susan? It's Sophia. Yeah.
It's Sophie. I mean, how do you pronounce it?
Is it Sophia?
It's Kevin, actually.
Treat it well.
I didn't want to correct you, but it's...
The S is silent. It's just OV.
Yeah. All right.
Which, you know, it's quite famous for the fact that it was a play written by a woman. It was staged on Broadway, and this is in the 20s, and this is the first revival on Broadway since then, which is a little shocking. It's a well-known expressionist text.
Why don't you go ahead and define that for us?
Define it? Sure. I think it's...
Yeah, no, that's the right definition.
I know. How's the best way to talk about expressionist theater? It's very symbolic.
I withdraw my question.
Thank you.
What's it about?
It's about this woman and the roles in which she plays in her life. And each scene is set up as... kind of a symbol of womanhood and, you know, there's a scene where she is single. There's a scene where she gets married. There's a scene where she is having an affair. And it ends poorly for her. It's supposed to be representative of, I think, an every woman question.
What I sort of liked about it is it's this expressionistic, sort of very stark, very mechanized narrative about watching this woman spiral downward into insanity and personal ruin based on these steps in her life that seem to be moments when she comes up against expectations of womanhood and femininity, and...
Like her desires against society's expectations.
Exactly.
And constantly in conflict.
Constantly in conflict, in which she loses everyone, even when she has bright moments, when it looks like she might break free of these cages, these many different types of cages that she's been placed in, including a very memorable scene, which she, as you mentioned, has an affair, which we had a great deal of fun talking about on Twitter, because the two actors in that scene, Morgan Spector, the fellow, and our star, who is Rebecca Hall from Vicky Cristina Barcelona fame, they're both very attractive people, and it's very serious, expressionistic, you know, important piece of theater, and we couldn't stop talking about how pretty everybody was.
I mean, but thank God for the sexy, because it is a lot of not sexy the rest of the time.
Right.
Somebody asked me, like, oh, is it boring? And I'm like, well, it's important, is my answer.
Yes.
Which means yes.
So that's how I felt about it while I was watching it, which is like, here I am taking my theater vegetables. Yes. I'm seeing Machinal, and now I'll have seen this play.
Yes, and it's an important play to see, and it's an important play to talk about. And I think the reason why I'm kind of like focusing on the expressionism is that I saw Strange Interlude last year, which is, if you're not familiar with it, a Eugene O'Neill play from about the same time period about a woman who fights against sort of societal expectations. It's about 200 years long. as you're sitting in the audience, I think there were
Eugene
actually,
O'Neill. No,
I think there were actually two intermissions, and in the UK, I think they actually reduced them to 15 minutes because. It just, I mean, normally they have 20-minute intermissions. It was epically long. And it was, you know, a rare sight to see this professional production of this large, substantial Eugene O'Neill play that's not often performed, because it also, he had this, a lot of very strange sort of direct address used in the play, where characters are wearing conceptually masks in their relationships with people. And when they break free from that mask and they sort of speak to the audience about their true wants and desires. And it's very weird. It's not naturalistic in any way, shape, or form. And Machinal comes out of the same place as that piece. And so I guess I've been thinking about that in terms of the two plays together, because they are about these women who are just, you know, struggling with the world of expectations for themselves and their own personhood. And it's interesting to see, obviously, a female writer writing about this at a time where women had a lot more free, you know, if we think about the 20s versus the 30s and 40s, I mean, it was that brief window of liberation for women in a lot of ways. You know, before you had like the Hays Code in Hollywood, which started editing down movies to, you know, punish people for their misdeeds. I think we forget that there was that time period where women were depicted as actually being, you know, people with wants and desires. But, you know, in this play, she also meets her, you know, demise for wanting things.
And we should mention that the play, the reason why we're calling it a little strange is Sophie Treadwell's dialogue is very stilted and very repetitive, by design, I should say, not as a criticism of the text. It sort of... The worlds, the cages I described before that are sort of placed around the Rebecca Hall character are sort of... Are bolstered by the men and, should we say, other women in this play who are constantly driving her mad with repeating the same dialogue over and over again. The scene changes feel very mechanized. The set feels very stark, deep blacks and bright whites and these crazy shadows. So it feels a little unnerving and certainly unnatural the way that it's presented. But I really liked the play. I kind of went in not knowing what to expect. It's a very old play. I was like, why is this being revived on Broadway kind of thing. I thought it was haunting in every possible way. I was absolutely bowled over by the set design. I thought that was extraordinary.
The design was fantastic. It was just, the color palette, the whole thing was fantastic.
The way in which it moves and the way in which it closes in on her and sort of each turn. I mean, when you're talking about, you know, the people repeating things and doing things and boxing her in, the set itself is physically doing that as it's happening.
And it just, I felt this intense claustrophobia in my chair as the play went on and started to kind of feel her panic, and every time that it's stamped down and repressed, either by herself or by other people in her life, I kind of felt my breath quickening a little bit more. It was a very well cast spell as far as I was concerned.
I mean, I think it's a fantastic production of this play that I still feel like is more important than not boring. Like, I didn't feel, I mean, because it's not about feeling in some ways.
Right.
I mean, it's not about her. It's hard. I feel like it's hard for me now after a lifetime of, you're saying you're trying to find the narrative in certain material that, you know, is intentionally non-narrative. You know, I'm always looking for the emotion and the connection, and it's a play that intentionally acts against that and sort of cuts against that. Mm. And I didn't connect with it, I think, as much as I had anticipated I would.
Yeah. Hard to connect in the traditional sense. There are moments, though, another cool aspect of the way that Treadwell breaks down the play and introduces us to this character is she has these long monologues that are stream of consciousness, like her actual id processing what's happening to her and actually speaking to the audience very, very
frantically
and honestly about what she wants and what she's scared about and what's happening to her. But then, of course, when she actually speaks in the real world, she does not do that. And so, yeah, I take your point, though. I wasn't emotionally connected to it, but I was. It felt like I said before. It felt like a spell that was being cast around. I didn't connect to it, but I was sort of entranced by it.
And it's 90 minutes, so it moves quite quickly through the phases of her life. And again, this set, I mean, I just want to point out, this is the creative team that I've been sort of harping about. Mm-hmm. Lindsay Turner's the director, and S. Devlin, who recently also did Midsummer Night's Dream for the Julie Taymor production, did the scenic design for that, are coming out of the UK, just having done Chimerica, which was wildly well-received, also a play that involves sort of a rotating cube in that. But here, I mean, I hate to say that, S. Devlin doing another rotating square here, a rectangle and not a cube, but it really works, and it really serves the purpose of, you know, as you're sort of saying, sort of boxing her in and trapping her and seeing the spinning of society. I mean, maybe it is that sort of just the repetition of that space and her experiences and those people and those lines. So I do feel like all aspects of the production are feeding into it. But there was a part of me that was like, I kind of want this to be a little weirder. Like, I feel like you kind of have to go... all out weird with this, and in some ways it wasn't weird enough. Granted, I saw one of the early previews, so it may have sort of come together better as time has gone on. But
I often struggle with historical pieces, and I'm sure it's just because I can't get outside of my own contemporary view of the world, but struggle to find the situations that people find themselves in realistic and therefore have sympathy for them. And I know that's a huge personal failing on my part, but I often, when I go to plays that are historical relics, find that I don't understand the decisions people make. They don't seem realistic. The assumptions that are made about people's motivations and the pressures that they face, societal pressures, family pressures, peer pressure, coworker pressure. It all seems so artificial.
It's interesting because I have this feeling about, like you mentioned, like, you know, sort of plays we think of as being historical. One of the ways that I think that disconnect happens is that a lot of people who produce plays like this, or even Shakespeare, Aeschylus, whatever you want to do, don't quite understand where the world in which the play was written, and make very sort of half-assed attempts to make that connect to a contemporary audience. That doesn't mean like dressing Shakespeare in jeans. What it means is you need to find, there's a reason these plays have been around for centuries, in this case about a century in the case of Machinal, and you just need to find what that is and play it honestly. And, you know, if that didn't happen this time, you know, it's not, I struggle sometimes, I'm resistant to blame it on the play and more willing to sort of attribute that to how it's performed.
I blame you, Lindsay, actually.
That's totally fair.
I mean,
you know, one thing I had was that, I don't know how you guys felt, but Rebecca Hall, to me, I felt was a tad too urbane to play this sort of wilting flower naive character.
She's so tall and striking. It's like I had this hard time with Vanessa Redgrave in Long Day's Journey and Tonight.
Oh, fair, yeah.
To be this, you know, woman overcome with her morphine addiction and sort of diminished in some way when you have this strapping woman who is so strong and striking. And I mean, you can't help but like look at Vanessa Redgrave and be like, whoa, she has all the power. And in, you know, in a role that is traditionally not about sort of a powerful woman. So, I mean, I think it's interesting to see Rebecca Hall in this piece, which I haven't seen her on stage before. This is her Broadway debut, actually. Mm-hmm. But I do also want to point out, however, Morgan Spector was in his underwear in the sexy scene.
He was in underpants.
So it's definitely worth seeing for that.
We have not talked enough about his tattoos.
Yes.
Are they real? What do you guys think?
I'm
assuming they're real.
Okay. I mean, I did Google Morgan Spector tattoos.
I was going to say, I feel like in Russian Transport, didn't I think
there's very little online about them.
I feel a craptacular article coming on.
Can they get on that, please?
I think that does seem right in their wheelhouse.
All right, I'm sending a letter to the editor over there.
But yeah, a handsome tattooed man who is sort of the main character's one, you know, brief moment of hope that she might be able to escape.
And I kind of love that speakeasy scene.
Oh, that
because
was so cool.
I don't even know how to sort of set the stage for it, but you have various conversations happening at other tables, and there's a gay couple, a man who's trying to take a man home. There's a couple talking about the woman getting an abortion. Mm-hmm. And then there is Rebecca Hall and her friend come in and meet up with two guys, and they go off and they're married. And so they're, you know, hooking up with other people. And it all takes place in essentially a speakeasy. And it is just sort of the most interesting kind of window on a time if you're talking about sort of trying to connect to what was happening historically. I guess for me, that scene put it in a little bit more context, the taboo subjects of the era.
Yeah, but there were some things I just didn't get. And this is getting into the weeds, but that man she marries in the beginning, why doesn't she like him? He seems like a fine person. And if she doesn't like him, then I'm sorry that she got forced to marry him. But to me, I needed him to be a little bit more of a villain almost.
It's always, I think it's a hard time with Michael Kumsty because he is kind of a sort of a goofy, charming, like, I don't know.
To me, it wasn't the actor. At least it wasn't reading that way to me.
I mean, because he could have been a very predatory boss. And I think when I was actually, like, my notes, when I was taking notes during the show, I was sort of like, I kind of expected this level of, like, it's her boss that she ends up marrying. And so I expected there to be some sort of
pressure.
And the pressure is society. Like,
yeah, it comes from her mother. Married.
The amazing Suzanne Bertish, I just want to point out in that part as the mother. Yeah, it's this, I kind of saw it as, like, other characters and other things in the show, he's so robotic and so does not understand her and makes no effort to understand her and just likes to have her as the wife that he can take around.
Right. They're
and
all
be
playing
married to.
Roles, and so his role is like, I am the guy that has the money, so I need the wife to make my story complete, and you were the lady, and I like you, so let's do this.
And
which seemed like a good gig for her. I mean, that's the thing. I was like, I know that I'm supposed
so
to be.
So you agree with her mother?
No, I really don't, but it just felt like, I don't know.
It's not what she wanted.
Yeah.
I get that, and I'm sad that she had to do that. But, like, there are people with real problems, you know?
Well, this is getting a little...
I think this is less about Mashinal and more about you.
Yeah, this is about her story.
This has nothing to do with me. But the other plot point that I didn't get is I didn't understand why the... And this is a total spoiler, but I didn't understand why the Morgan Spector character rats her out.
It's made clear to me in the sexy time naked scene that we were referring to earlier that once they make love and she becomes very attached to him because it appears as though he's making an effort to understand her and love her and take her away, and she's kind of, you know, it's sort of the afterglow of sex with a man who understands her, that he really actually doesn't want anything to do. He's just a pretty girl and he has sex with her and he moves on. And so then when
he has his own wants.
Yeah, and but she doesn't see that or understand that, and so she carries his memory with her for, as we see, the rest of her life. And then when push comes to shove and she becomes very famous for doing something not too nice, and the man is reached for interview, I would have thought that, you know, this guy, if, you know, reporters came and said, what do you think of this woman that you used to know? He would have probably just said, oh, yeah, she's a crazy person. I don't really know. You know, like, he doesn't have anything invested in her.
I thought there was a reason, like, he was sort of forced by society, again, to sort of be honest about the situation or else consequences would come down on his head. Mm.
Okay, if that's right, that would make so much more sense, but that did not come through to me.
I thought, like, he's all. I mean, if we're probably cutting all this anyway. Like, he's in Mexico. Yeah. Like, he doesn't want to get extradited. I mean, am I making this shit up?
No, you're right.
No, you're all correct, but that's what I'm thinking. Like, he's on the beach in Mexico. Like, why does he have to go and point out unnecessarily that this woman
I don't
wasn't
think he volunteered.
She...
I mean, I thought he
no,
was...
They tracked him down and interviewed him, but... To me, there was not. It was not made clear that he was under any kind of pressure.
I thought just by saying Mexico, there was pressure. Yeah. I've seen too many movies.
He wanted to be there.
Well, no, like the Mexican police scare me, so I don't know. Like,
I mean, he himself had committed murder and gotten away with it. So I would have thought there's like, you know, what is that saying amongst thieves?
Honor.
Yeah. Honor amongst thieves.
Now we have to keep this section. Yeah. All right.
Let me ask you this.
Ask me this.
Would you recommend this play to people?
Yes.
With what qualifications?
Okay. I would say that it is unlike anything for those who prefer to go uptown to see their shows. I think this is something that
there was so much judgment in what you just said.
No, not really. But no, this is. I mean, if we can use the B word,
if you insist in seeing a show on 42nd Street,
yeah, you're not used to seeing this kind of thing on 42nd Street. You're not, and I think that it is a really interesting play. It's incredibly well done. And I think it's an opportunity in a very commercial environment for people to kind of go outside their comfort zone a little bit and not go see that new splashy jukebox musical. And like I say, I mean,
if people are the type that are looking for a jukebox musical, they're not going to like this.
No, it's not for everybody.
I think this is a huge risk for Roundabout, and I think it's fantastic that they're taking this risk. And this is why, like, I know I've been harping on, like, the creative team. I think they've been bringing over some really interesting artists. They've been working with some really interesting artists. Doesn't always work. Picnic. I say that under my
voice. I love Sam Gold so much.
I love Sam Gold so much, but Picnic.
God, I cannot believe we're saying both these things in full-throated sentences. That we're admitting we didn't like Picnic directed by Sam Gold.
I love Sam Gold, but not. I haven't loved every single production he's directed. But I want him to keep doing what he's doing, and I want him to try different things. And the fact that, you know, I think his look back in anger at Roundabout was, again, like this crazy risk of a piece and a creative team, and the choices that he made were so outlandish for a traditional sort of big nonprofit, you know, theater company. So I'm thrilled that they're taking this risk. I'm thrilled that they're doing this. I think I could have gone a lot weirder. I think I said it. Yeah. Like, I would have loved to have actually seen Sam Gold direct this, you know, full on experimental production of Mosh and All. But I think the production that you have is, you know, so I think, you know, in terms of making it a recommendation, I kind of want people to see it because I think this creative team is really worth seeing. I think it's, again, it's 90 minutes, which I know I keep harping on, but it's like, if you're going to eat your vegetables, a 90 minute, you know, dosage of vegetables versus the strange interlude, which was like half of my life. Like, I think that play is actually still going on right now. I'm joking. It's like, it has like seven acts or something crazy.
But something this non-commercial and something this, successful, I think, for what it is I want to do nothing but encourage people to see that. You feel differently.
No, I look forward to reading your recommended if list on maxmoo.com.
Nice plug. Yeah.
Yeah, we did that. Okay, what else have we seen?
Okay, I saw something that I feel like fits in with nothing we've talked about. I saw the show What's It All About?
Oh.
The Burt Bacharach reimagined piece at New York Theater Workshop, which, I mean, is opposite end of the spectrum from everything we've been talking about for the last couple of weeks. But I have this like warm spot in my heart for Burt Bacharach music, and I was like, you know what? Let me go check this out. People have said it's really great. And I bought a ticket that they have on stage seating in sofas all around the stage. So I bought a ticket for that, which if you're going to go see this show, frankly, I think there's no other seat that you should sit in because it makes it a much more sort of intimate and cabaret style show if you're kind of on the set with the actors. But there is no plot. There is no narrative. It is Kyle Rabko apparently sat down with Burt Bacharach and was like, hey, I love your catalog. Let me reimagine it. And he did. And so he's got a group of young singers and bandmates performing the music of Burt Bacharach and, you know, acting out. I mean, the songs are incredibly narrative unto themselves. But and there is a slight gloss on it to sort of suggest it. You know, he talks about, Kyle sort of opens the show sort of saying, like, I wanted to make music for my generation. And so there's all of these moments in the show where they're trying to be like, we're hip and cool and young and we're wearing earbuds and taking selfies. And it doesn't work. There's no point in it. Just let it go. It's just Burt Bacharach music, you know, reinterpreted in a very different way that's fun and enjoyable. But the thing I'm having a hard time with is because it's in a theater, for me, the context of it is a little bit, you know, I'm like, this is a show that if I saw it at Joe's Pub, I'd be like, oh my God, this is so great. You guys should totally go see this. It's a great little sort of musical review of music that you might enjoy and hear in a different light. And that's really fun. And the interpreters are fantastic. And the minute you put it in a theater, I'm like, okay, so this is theater. What? And the contribution in the theater column for this piece is like nil. So I'm having this hard time because on its own, you know, on its face of what it intends to be, it's very successful. But what I expect of it, you know, it's sort of failing and I'm bringing my own, you know, context to it. But, you know, it's a hard time when you put something on stage to sort of say, okay, well, so, you know, you're making a piece of theater. What? You know, maybe, again, I'm looking for a narrative. There's no narrative. There's none. They're not even pretending there's one, really. I mean, they're trying with this sort of, you know, hipster stuff. But Stephen Hoggett did the movement and directed it. So there's, you know, and I just love, like, I don't know if you can fall in love with a gesture, but, like, I think I can. Because he has, there's just one scene.
Luckily, this is a visual medium, so why don't you demonstrate?
You all have to know, I'm Italian, so I talk with my hands all the time. So pretty much you're missing 90% of my performance here on this podcast that's happening around the microphone that I'm trying not to knock over into my cup of tea. But there is a scene where these two people are singing a song on a sofa, and one is holding a mixtape, and the other's holding a letter. And there's just this sort of gentle handoff of the two objects between the two of them on this chair. And it's so small and beautiful and lovely, but you just know it's like Stephen Hoggett, and I can't help but love everything that he does.
Oh, that's awesome.
Did you also love Once?
No, I hated it.
Did you like the movement?
I love the movement in it, yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
All right. And that is at the New York Theater Workshop.
That's at New York Theater Workshop.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, get a discount ticket. Don't pay full price because you won't get your, you know, $85 worth of theater out of it. But I know. But definitely get a stage seat and...
Can I ask you this, though? Because I've been debating whether or not I should see this show, but I know next to nothing about the music of Burt Bacharach. I know a couple of the hits. So if I am someone who doesn't have a deep familiarity with Burt Bacharach, will I like the show?
I mean, I don't see why not. It's, and it's hard for me to say because I was joking about this last night. I was like, I somehow weirdly associate all of Burt Bacharach's music with my parents' divorce.
Wow.
So. Both for all of the Carpenters albums that they owned and also their divorce. And it turns out like all of his songs are about breakups. I mean, there's a whole lot of songs about falling in love, and then there's a whole lot of songs about falling out of love.
Yeah.
And the woman sitting next to me on my little like sofa sobbing, like, and she was like a young person. I don't know what she was going through, but I suppose if you're going through a breakup, you probably shouldn't go see this show.
Okay. Good to know.
I mean, Kyle Rabko is adorable, and you know, I mean, the cast is adorable, and so I don't know. It's like one of those things you're like, I saw like young people in the audience between all the little gray-haired Q-tip ladies, and you're like, oh, yay, like people aren't coming out for this.
That's so cool.
And then there are obviously the people who are like, oh, it's a jukebox musical for music I like. Perfect.
Yeah.
And so I'm very torn because I had a good experience, but at the same time, I'm like, this is the end of theater. You know, like I feel a little bad about liking it.
I feel bad about liking it.
New York what?
Sorry, guys.
As you should.
I mean, I'm ashamed.
Okay.
So, yeah, if you don't have any familiarity
with
the music...
That's a really mixed recommendation.
It is. Well, I feel like it's...
Go, but only if you want to hate yourself in the morning.
I mean, this is like in the week that I saw, you know, Kate Tempest, who I feel like redefines the greatness of theater, this show is just, I mean, complete sugar. It's, you know, a sugary snack that is not in the same, it's not even on the same planet. And I shouldn't, you know, I hate to compare things because they aren't, you know, there aren't meant to be things. You should be able to sort of judge something on its own merits, you know, and it's a little musical review. It's delightful, but.
Not theater.
Not theater.
Okay. Hmm. Well, I'll go see it. Sure, let's go.
I think you should skip it.
Okay. Ooh. All right.
I don't know. It just doesn't. I know. I mean, Bacharach does nothing for me. So on that level,
I think
not
I'm
me,
not.
But
much...
you have limited time. There are other things to see. Like
life's short. Skip the Bacharach. Okay. Can I talk about a show?
I don't know. Maybe.
Okay. Please. Because last time we recorded the podcast, I was talking about a show called Outside Mullingar.
I remember.
By John Patrick Shanley. And at the end of the last podcast, I was super excited to see it because I love the John Patrick Shans and I loved Doubt. It was one of my favorite plays ever. And I'm just a huge fan of his. And he's back on Broadway with this play, Outside Mullingar, which is, as we mentioned last time, is a story about two 40-something people in Ireland living on two adjoining farms who find love through their parents' legacies, as well as their own sort of longstanding will-they-won't-they romantic tension. And the lovers are played by, is it Brian O'Byrne?
Isn't it Brian O'Byrne?
Brian O'Byrne? Okay.
It has an accent.
Who's in Doubt?
And
Deborah Messing from Will and Grace plays the other. And I was super
also
excited.
Also Smash. Let's not, yeah. You know.
And there's lots of Irish accents and turns of phrase and things. And it's and I was really excited to see it. And guys, I wasn't a huge fan of it. I was a little let down, mostly because it was the other side of John Patrick Shanley that we haven't seen in a while. There's the Doubt.
The Moonstruck days.
The Moonstruck. And actually, funnily enough, this show is marketed as, they put on the marquee, an Irish Moonstruck is what it's referred to as.
I would like to say for the record,
yeah.
We studied Moonstruck in film school because it is a classic, like, three-act structure, perfect screenplay in terms of mainstream cinema. So I just want to say, like, it is...
I'm not... I'm in no way putting down necessarily the qualities of Moonstruck. He won an Oscar for a screenplay of that John Patrick Shanley did.
And gave a fantastic Oscar speech, if you all...
Oh, yeah, yeah, right. No, but so I think the
He thanked everybody he's ever, like, punched or kissed him. I mean, it was a really... It's classic.
And I think the thing that was that let me down is there's a lot of... it's a well-structured play, kind of, and it's... It's got a lot of weird sort of John Patrick Shanley oddities. I think he has a real talent for the odd things people say and do. Quirky seems like too mild a word for what I think he's very good at. But this felt to me just like a very flimsy rom-com that didn't have a whole lot of substance, didn't say a lot to me about the idea of legacy and inheritance in Irish culture or even Irish American culture, which if I don't know if you guys have read the John Patrick Shanley wrote this op-ed in the New York Times about how he wrote this play and how it was about him reconnecting with his very Irish roots and about searching for his father. And I just didn't get any of that in this. I just felt like it was, I knew from the word go that these two, you know, middle-aged people who had missed each other so many times were going to get together at the end. We knew that was going to happen. And so we're just kind of sitting around for a long time with scenes that are way too long, scenes that, where there's, starts with a lot of romantic tension, but then it quickly fizzles out. Performances that are very spotty. Bruno Byrne is fantastic, and I should point out, though. Yeah, I just felt very disappointed. It just felt like I wanted this to be a full meal, and it was just kind of a little trifle. I don't know. I guess I expected more. Should I have expected more? I don't know. But, yeah. Sorry, Brian. John Patrick Shanley. I'll go to the next one. I'll be at anything he does. But Outside Mullingar, for those of you who are fans of his, you won't miss much if you don't make it out.
It's funny because I don't associate romantic comedy with theater that often. Like, I'm sort of thinking back, and like, I ended up with on my top 10 list, I included Tally's Folly.
Yeah, okay.
Which was, I felt like, slightly controversial for me. Because some people were like, oh, you know, it's that roundabout doing something, you know, totally safe. But it's the kind of romance that there is tons of dramatic tension, and there are reasons why this couple aren't coming together that are historical, that are, regional that are very emotional, and I like that. I like that, like, somehow in what could have been a very kind of throwaway romance, as we tend to see in movies, here was this piece of theater where the stakes just felt a little bit richer. And maybe because the performers were so fantastic in that, Sarah Paulson and Danny Bernstein were incredible. And I'm typically not a Danny Bernstein fan and sort of became one. He won me over with that. Wow. I know, which is another piece of controversy for me.
I like him.
Everybody does, except me.
No, but the rom-com thing is interesting. This show in particular, I think what you're talking about, these romantic stakes, were just not there for me. I didn't quite understand why these two weren't getting together, aside from just because
you're like,
stubbornness.
From scene one.
Yeah, right? because stubbornness, why are we doing this kind of thing?
There are people with real problems out there.
Lindsay's like, come on. Come on, Ireland. This is ridiculous.
This has no place in the theater.
We're on a farm. Done. No, but it's, you know, there's these whole stretches about the two, Deborah Messing and Bruno Burns' parents and their sort of, you know, generations-old war and stuff that just doesn't really matter. And I got to this point where the final scene of the play is actually the best in it. But that's when the romantic tension and the weirdness of these two characters actually comes together and kind of breaks open a little bit. And I actually had this thought where I was like, this is where the play should have started. And the second I thought that, I was like, oh, man, it made it tragic to me, because I was like, if we started right here, if it was this little one-act play, it would have been really, really cool. But we just spent, you know, an hour and 15 minutes leading up to this, droning onto this, and it... Yeah, that was...
disappointing.
Alas, but like I said, if he writes another thing, I'll be there.
He hasn't first performance. He hasn't burned the bridge yet.
Absolutely
the fan
not.
Is still
absolutely
there.
Not. No, no.
Okay. All right. But what other shows are we going to see? Let's just move 1 week ahead.
I'm seeing a bunch of stuff that following week.
Like what?
I'm seeing the Acting Company's production of Hamlet. I'm seeing The Bridges of Madison County.
Ooh.
I'm finally seeing Mark Rylance's 12th Night.
Oh.
And then on Friday, I'm seeing Stop Hitting Yourself.
Are we recording this point?
Yeah.
Oh, we are. Oh.
He's not by his mic.
I didn't realize. Sorry. Should I?
What do you think? We're just... Give me your lesson.
I just came back from the bathroom. There's a whole thing.
Well, now that's on tape, too.
Great. No, that's fine. All right. Yeah.
What are you seeing?
I am seeing a lot of stuff in the coming weeks.
A thing of Hamlet. Ugh,
I know.
So
I've been the serial offender of seeing a lot of Shakespeare on behalf of Maximo, and I love it. I love going to Shakespeare.
Did you see the Bedlam Hamlet?
I did see the Bedlam Hamlet.
Do I want to go see the Bedlam
Hamlet?
No, but you
do.
No, you
want to.
Yeah, skip Hamlet. Go see St. Joan. It is crazy good, and which is funny because it's
and I
want to
see more Shaw. So it's been on my list.
It's
I saw Pygmalion last year for the first time, and I was like, my goodness, George Bernard Shaw is very good at what he does. And I was like, why have I not somehow seen more of this? No, but speaking to political theater, like the incredible like political dialogue in Pygmalion, which gets completely lost in My Fair Lady, is fabulous. It is so dynamic, so interesting. And I'm like, why the hell did I not realize this? Because I'm an idiot. Okay, fine. Everyone else probably knew this. But although, no, I guarantee you, people Google all the time social commentary in Pygmalion and come up with my blog post. So I'm helping every child in Pakistan write their book report on Pygmalion, because it must be assigned a lot because all of my traffic comes from Pakistan.
That's interesting.
Okay.
But the Bedlam St. Joan also brings to light a lot of the, I mean, it's, you know, it, that there's so much dialogue in that play about the relationship between the state and the church at the time of Joan of Arc. And yeah, it's brought to life brilliantly. And there's I think if in less skilled hands, Shaw, that aspect of Shaw could just seem so boring. But in the way Bedlam does it, because it's this fast and furious foursome, look at that alliteration, come on, that they find a way to bring out the humor in it without necessarily making fun of or just kind of glazing over what the actual content of the Shaw is. It's a really beautiful balancing act that they do for 3.5 hours of this show. It's just crazy good. I'm going back to seeing a lot more Shakespeare. I like to do it.
And you're seeing Twelfth Night for the first time.
Seeing Twelfth Night for the first time. For some reason, I was able to get a ticket to that, but Richard III, you can't... I can't get a decently priced ticket to that. I don't know if I'm willing to spend $150 to go see Richard, but I definitely want to see Twelfth Night.
It's a really unique interpretation, but I guess between the two of them, if you see Twelfth Night...
Well, they did an extension, and I think 5/6...
Right, but people had not seen.
The extension is Twelfth Night performances, and only I want to say two or four. Yeah, they totally changed up the the
people weren't
ratio.
Feeling Richard. Yeah, no, I'm very excited.
And make sure you go early for the pre-show show.
Yes, I have heard about the dressing of the actors and the whole bit. I'm very very excited for that.
And you're going to see Stop Hating Yourself at Lincoln Center.
Yeah, which actually I would like you to talk about because I think you're more I'm just seeing it because everyone's telling me to, but I would love to hear why you're excited about this show.
Well, a person I know who I consider to have good taste in theater said it was good.
Okay. That's
turns
a good
out
reason
word
to know.
Of mouth is all we need, folks.
Yeah, that's it.
No, I mean,
take
it's
that,
by
ben
this
Brantley.
Austin-based theater company called Rude Mechanicals, Rude Max. And apparently they create great stuff. And it's so weird because all of the advertising for it just talks about queso. I think there's like a queso fountain.
Go on. Yeah.
I also know that this is coinciding with a Velveeta shortage, so I don't know how that's going to work.
I can't wait to report back. Cheese fountain? I'm going to move my ticket to next week. It's crazy.
I'm going to see that too, but not next week. Not until the 29th, I think.
Okay. Yeah, and then it's me. For me, I'm just counting down to Kung Fu. I am so pumped to see Kung Fu, you guys. I'm a big David Henry Huang person.
I was going to say, are you a big sports and theater person?
Not so. I mean, even though I said all that stuff about Tyson versus Ali a little while ago, no, I'm actually not that much of a, like, let's bring sports to theater. Like, I'm not seeing Bronx Bombers, I'll tell you that right now.
I will say, I saw Magic Bird.
Me too.
Very much enjoyed it.
Did you really?
Wow.
I mean, A, it turns out my long standing love of Peter Scolari from Bosom Buddies was reignited with Passion. Talk about arm porn.
I'm just excited about the Dave Henry Huang. Hasn't done anything new in a while, and all the early buzz I've heard about workshops about the show are just through the roof enthusiastic. So, yeah.
Well, and critically, tickets during the initial run of that show are only $25.
Go signature.
Oh, yeah, I know. I need to. All
go
right.
Signature, go.
I can't remember if I bought a ticket to this or not.
The day it went on sale, I jumped on that. I had to.
I need to.
I know, because those tickets tend to sell out.
Oh, they
quickly.
Do. Yeah. There are a couple things, not next week, but soon, that I want to flag. One is the civilians are doing a Let Me Ascertain You at Joe's Pub on sexual variants. And these performances by the civilians are basically they go out and they do all these interviews and then they cut them down into monologues, and then members of the civilians
sort of acting company
act them out. They deliver them on stage, and I've seen two past performances on different topics, and they've been uniformly great, and I think that these shows are really exciting.
Yeah, I think, you know, when you're talking about bringing interesting voices into theater, the way in which the civilians uses verbatim work to bring attention to different people, different communities, and really find that sort of beautiful, humane core to everybody's stories. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the Let Me Ascertain You series, which is also available on podcasts after the show, so if you're unable to actually see them live at Joe's Pub, there is a way, and you can certainly see back episodes as well. Although I would say, you know, seeing them performed live, I mean, I will never forget Janine Sirleaf doing this incredible monologue about a woman who was in Colombia who goes to prison and has a near-death experience. And it was one of the funniest things I've ever seen, ever.
Wow. Yeah, I'm really,
I think actually it's on YouTube. There's a video of it on YouTube, and it's absolutely worth seeing. But yeah, I'm excited about that one. I'm also excited to see Coriolanus, the NT Live screening of that, which is coming up at the end of January and running through their different screening dates around New York. This is the production at the Don Moore Warehouse in London right now, starring Tom Hiddleston, that some people might know as Loki from
Loki.
Thor and the Avengers and whatnot. getting a lot of buzz from my friends in the UK who've seen it. You know, beyond being fans of Tom Hiddleston, it is a really, it sounds like a really exciting, engaging production. There's also, I mean, again, if I'm going to be, you know, the person to keep pointing these things out, there's a shower scene and also male-on-male kissing between Tom Hiddleston and Hadley Frazier. So be still my beating heart. I'm very excited about those things.
Did I know Hadley Frazier was in this?
I don't, you should have, but because there's been tons of pictures on Tumblr of the two of them rehearsing with their
knees. Again, I'm not familiar with the with website you're knees. Talking about. So.
I feel like I am the teenage girl participant here in the podcast. Oh my gosh.
This is a really cute, this is a really cool show, and there's cute boys in it.
What? I mean, I have also heard grumblings about people misbehaving in the theater because they are, you know, just like fangirling.
Ugh.
I know. The worst. I do not endorse or encourage that kind of behavior. But I'm very excited that we'll at least have an opportunity to see it here because the Dahmer is incredibly tiny, hard to get tickets, and I'm not in London. So.
Oh, I see.
Oh, there's that.
And there's that little ocean between us that's creating a problem. But with the NT Live screenings, you know, it's funny, people are concerned. Are they going to somehow replace, you know, people going to the theater if they only see the cinema version? No, of course not. But it definitely gives us an opportunity to see some things we would not have otherwise had an opportunity to see. And for those who haven't actually seen any of the cinema screenings, they have like multiple camera setups. And it's a very, I mean, for somebody who comes from film and struggles with theater on film, I was really worried about how
it would feel.
And I don't love it. It's not my favorite. I still would prefer to go see the original production. But if it's my only opportunity, I'm, you know, going to take an opportunity to see it. And they do really try to make it an engaging cinema experience of the theatrical piece.
Yeah. After we see Coriolanus and Frankenstein, we should do an episode about them.
Okay.
Anything else?
Not the time being. Just going to finish up this Under the Radar Festival gauntlet that I'm doing. 8 more shows for a total of 16.
What's the best one you've seen so far?
The best Under the Radar show I've seen so far is probably a tie between El Año Que Nací, The Year I Was Born by Lola Arias, and something that I never thought that I saw it yesterday and it stayed with me. It's called Eternal. And it was a one-day-only performance by an artist named Daniel Fish, who does kooky, zany experimental work. And this show is called Eternal because when you go into the theater, there are two screens, and they play a video of two actors who perform the final scene from the film Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind on a loop for 2 hours.
Durational work. I fucking love it.
It is, and it sounds like crazy. It's you know, no way to wrap your head around what this experience is going to be like when you go into the theater, but I'll tell you, it did something to me. It was not only just on face value a lesson in, you know, deep hardcore Meisner acting, but also, you know, how to interpret a scene, and it was a lesson in improv and a lesson in stamina and a lesson in, you know, mind-numbing repetition. But it was also a test for the audience, too. Daniel Fish came out before the show and said, by the way, guys, this is really challenging, so if you want to lie down or you need to leave, feel free. And no one knew what this was going to be, so we were just like, what? And I tell you, I had to, like, during a couple rounds of the scene, it's about an 8-minute scene that they perform constantly for 2 hours, I had to, like, look at the floor a couple times because I started to get hypnotized, and I left that theater deeply discombobulated, like the feeling of having your brain scrambled, but I was walking on air. I was so literally hypnotized by this show, and unfortunately, y'all listening can't see it because it was only a one-time-only performance, but, man, Daniel Fish is super interesting, and I imagine he'll be kicking around town for a little while and coming back in some capacity, so those are the two, and there's a bunch of other really cool stuff that I saw. Just go, pick another radar show. You're not gonna go wrong.
Okay, I have to talk about durational work for like a second because it is like my heart now. I had no idea I would love it so much. And I think it's the kind of thing that people on the face of it, you're like, why would I go see something repeat itself constantly for 2 hours?
Precisely.
That seems crazy. And it is that like instant, you mention it to somebody and you get this knee jerk reaction of like, that just sounds stupid. That sounds like a waste of time. Or like, I don't know sure why that would be good. And I saw a piece last year that was 6 hours of a band playing live the same song over and over again for 6 hours. And I didn't know what to expect. It was The National playing their song Sorrow, and the piece was called A Lot of Sorrow.
And, that was clever.
Right. Witty. And it's this Icelandic artist whose name I will never be able to pronounce, who came up with the idea and the concept and the structure. And I went and I brought a book with me and I brought a cup of tea and I was like, okay, so I'm going to listen to them play a couple rounds and I'm going to go out and, you know. And so, you know, it just, it became this enveloping experience after 6 hours of, and you know, you look at each loop, you look at each piece of it separately, and then the entire experience together forms something else. And I think that was what I wasn't expecting. The like, yes. The multi-layer, the repetition somehow actually stops becoming repetitive.
Yeah.
You notice the differences. You start to feel those differences. It impacts you in a different way. And that overall durational experience has an impact on you as an audience member in a way in which you're completely unprepared for.
Yeah, especially because after about 40 times, you start to know, like, I could perform that scene right now, word for word, both parts. And so then it becomes like, how is she gonna, she took a pause there that time. Oh, that was interesting. Or, oh, she's crying on that word, and then he's laughing. And it just became this, it was sort of like, it was a test in like watching variances happen. It felt very much like some sort of a physics experiment of like, you know, I'm trying to think of the word, like not singularity, but like anomalies that sort of pop up and how those, you know, get into your mind and mess around with your already scrambled brains. That's
awesome. Cool. We'll bring future durational works to our attention.
Yay.
Cool. Wrap.
Wrap.
Thank you so much for joining us on the MaxMoo podcast. Information about all of the shows we discussed is at maxmoo.com. Just click on podcasts. You can find all of us on Twitter. MaxMoo is at MaxMoo. Nicole is at Mildly Bitter. That's MildlyBitter. Jack is at Jack in Brooklyn. That's JackinBrooklyn. And I'm at Lindsay Behrens. LindsayBarenz. See you next week.